59 near Lake Michigan. Friday should be sunny and 83. New numbers are in. Wind is calm. The sun is shining. 62 degrees Kenosha, 60 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For as much as has been written about the American Civil War, there are still fascinating and amazing stories yet to be uncovered and told. One such story can be found in a brand new book called Captured Freedom. It is the story behind an iconic photograph from the Civil War, a photograph that for many years was misidentified as showing a group of Confederate soldiers, when in fact it's a group of Union soldiers. Nine of them who escaped from a Confederate prison, Camp Sorghum, in Columbia, South Carolina, in November 1864. They made their way to the north more than 350 miles, and along the way they needed the help of many people, including some enslaved men and women, as well as some Southerners sympathetic to the North. After these nine soldiers reached Knoxville, Tennessee, they decided that they and their three mountain guides who had helped them should pose together for a photograph. Stephen Procco has managed to tell the story behind this photograph, uncovering an amazing amount of material about each of these men and what they experienced together in their long, difficult journey towards freedom. Stephen Procco is an Emmy Award-winning documentarian whose previous book is called Rebel Correspondent. This newest book is called Captured Freedom, the epic, true Civil War story of Union POW officers escaping from a Southern prison. Could you give us just a rough idea of when one is trying to dig into history that is this distant, where do you go? What are the most valuable resources that would allow you to, for instance, identify these men once and for all and reveal something about them, what they had experienced even before the war and what they experienced after the war? I mean, where did you have to go and to what lengths did you have to go to uncover as much information as you did?
Well, it was a giant research project, that's for sure. The first steps were, because the Library of Congress had some of the names penciled in, just last names and such, I was able to actually start there. And I find that in researching not just the men in this photograph, but other people within the book, that a good starting point is to actually build family trees to try to understand who they are. And so I actually used Ancestry.com to do a lot of research and build family trees. The second step was, who's still alive as descendants of these men today? And what do they know about it? And so that was the second approach, was, okay, the photograph, when you look at the picture, to me, the faces of the men, there's personalities that are standing out. You realize also that this is an old picture, and for some reason, maybe you were biased, you know, they're older men. But in reality, the oldest man in the picture is 32 years old. The youngest officer is 18, and the youngest person is 14. One of the guides is only 14 years old. And it turned out that that guide, this 14-year-old guide, through just pure chance, I came across the story of a girl writing for a contest in around 1980. She was probably, I want to say 10, 12 years old, and she'd written about this boy. And this was the boy's three or four times great-granddaughter writing this as a children's story. And sure enough, I managed to find a copy of the book. It's been out of print for years and years. And so then I had somebody to search for. Of course, she was, you know, young at that time. Now she's a grown woman. Ended up, she's living in Australia. And I, you know, through the wonders of the internet, found her in Australia and found her mother was living in the panhandle of Florida, reached out to her. And she sent me to the family historian, which is a woman living in Cashiers Valley, North Carolina, who is into genealogy and has written herself some things. And she shared with me original letters that were written between him and one of the other men in the photograph, literally sent me them. And I had the original copies that I was able to scan and send back to her then, that were correspondence in the 1880s, 1890s, and early 1900s between the boy, his name is T.R. Zachary, and one of the officers in the bottom left, his name is Mark Bassett. And that was fascinating because it also indicated to me a little bit about Mark Bassett and the fact that some of these photographs that are out there were a result of him making copies of his original. And when you talk about the Union County Historical Society picture, that came from another original photograph that somebody made copies of. That's a copy photograph as well, from a soldier that was in the 5th Iowa Infantry, and his name was Michael Hoffman, and lived in Union County, South Dakota. It would have been Dakota Territory after the war. So those are the things. You know, you uncover a couple things, and suddenly you got like four or five more clues. Hmm. And you keep going down those pathways and open other doors that surprise you.
Hmm. And the soldier in question, Mark Bassett, he sets down to type out the story of what he and these other men experienced, and does so the year before he died. And of course that and many other things help you illuminate this really fascinating story. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Steve Procco, author of Captured Freedom, which tells the story of a small group of Union soldiers captured by the Confederates who managed to escape and make their way to freedom. So there's a whole lot of things for us to explore and talk about. I think one of the things that is maybe kind of interesting in terms of setting the stage is to talk about when these men, these Union soldiers, were captured. And they weren't all captured at once. They weren't all part of the same regiment or company. But I know some of them were captured not long after Gettysburg and Vicksburg. And this was at a point in the war when the tide seemed to be turning towards the Union. And the way you describe their capture, at least some of these men, we get a sense that it is a terrible surprise. I mean, it comes at a moment when it seems as though the fortunes of the Union side are on the rise, and they had every reason to be optimistic, and then they are captured and of course subjected to terrible treatment. First of all, just briefly tell us a little bit about when these nine soldiers were captured and at what point in the conflict this occurred.
Well, they were all captured, like you mentioned, at different times. The first of them. First one captured was Mark Bassett, the one I mentioned earlier with the correspondence. He was captured in July of 1863. He had been part of the siege of Vicksburg and then was sent to Jackson, Mississippi with his company and captured there in really a huge mistake on the part of the officers commanding his regiment and several other regiments. It was just horrible situation that got him captured. So that was he was the first one. The next was the group from Iowa. There were three Iowa soldiers in this picture, but the fifth Iowa was fighting in Chattanooga in November of 1863, and they were captured in an area called Tunnel Hill, which is on the north side of where the whole battle was. They were part of Sherman's army, and another situation of just wrong place, wrong time, battle won by the Union, but a huge amount of the members of the regiment captured and quickly moved by the Confederates, because the Confederates were retreating at that point, and they ended up also, the three of them, and several others that were important to the story, in Libby Prison in Richmond. Then you had another gentleman that was in a West Virginia regiment, and if you can imagine, West Virginia became a state in 1863, and so in late 1863, December, he was part of a raiding party that successfully raided Salem, Virginia, and on the way back, as the officer in charge of the ambulance corps, which would be in the rear of the whole group of cavalry that was racing back from this raid, he was captured. And then you get into 1864, and you have one of the officers from the 15th New Jersey captured at the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse in Virginia. You have then two from the 4th Kentucky Infantry captured in July of 1864, south of Atlanta, and this was during right around the Battle of Atlanta, and right afterwards in a raid that General Stoneman was involved with. And on literally the same day, you had an officer in what was called the 19th USCI. It was United States Colored Infantry. He was a white officer in one of the companies of that regiment, captured at the Battle of the Crater, which was a famous battle that occurred outside of Petersburg, Virginia. And he was one of the men with his men who ran down into the crater after the crater was created in a huge explosion, and was captured there. So they were all over the place, and they were from regiments from Iowa to New Jersey. And they were imprisoned, five of them at Libby Prison, and then the rest of them moved around, because around May 1864, Libby, which is where most officers were being housed, they decided was too dangerous for the capital of the Confederacy, and they decided to move the officers south, and they moved them to Macon, and then they moved them to Charleston, South Carolina, before they ended up in Columbia, South Carolina.
Hmm. You make an interesting point in describing these Confederate prisons that I think is worth just briefly talking about, because this helps answer the question of how these men and many, many others were actually able to escape prison. I don't remember now which prison you were specifically talking about. It might have been Camp Libby, but you talk about the kind of men who would be employed as prison guards. And this is what you write at one point. The prison guards were a motley crew of local militia and rejected rebel soldiers. To be a reject of the Confederate Army that was always in need of manpower meant that you had to really be an incompetent soldier. And these men were exactly that. And so, I mean, maybe not every single one, but I mean, generally speaking, we are talking about a fair amount of incompetency when it came to the prison guards. And so it sounds like that was one factor that that allowed escapes to occur. And it sounds like by the time the men we're talking about escaped, it was becoming more and more common. And soldiers were escaping by the dozens, if not by the hundreds. Tell us more about this reality in these Confederate prisons.
Well, let's talk two prisons then. Libby Prison was an earlier prison in the scheme of things. So from in the story, mid-1863 to May of 1864, Libby was pretty locked up in terms of escapes. However, there were escapes, and one of the most famous ones was really the great escape of the Civil War, where 109 or so men tunneled out of the cellar of Libby Prison. Mark Bassett, in the photograph, was one of those men, and roughly half of them successfully made it back over Union lines. Mark Bassett was not one of those men. He was recaptured several days later. That was a remarkable feat to do in a prison that basically was three stories tall with a basement, and they tunneled out of the basement, where the men were locked up in the second and third floor. And so the fact that they were able to actually do that says something probably about how well they were watched, I would say, inside the prison. Jump forward to the last prison that they were in, which was Camp Sorghum. It's an entirely different scenario by now. Now we're talking about October of 1864, and things are falling apart. Atlanta has fallen. Sherman is marching to the sea. And, you know, this prison that they were moved to, they were moved from Charleston to Columbia because of a yellow fever epidemic that was happening in Charleston. At the time, they didn't understand what caused yellow fever. And so suspect were these prisoners of war that were being housed in the middle of town. So they moved them to Columbia, and they basically moved them into a big empty field and surrounded them by these type of guards you're mentioning, which were either very young or old men, very poorly supervised. They, at that stage, I believe the Confederate Army was in such need of manpower that anybody that was between, you know, 16 years old in the 40s, were off fighting battles wherever the battles were. And so having men left over to guard prisoners of war was a difficult thing. And this also brings up another point. I don't think there was an understanding by either side of the quantity, the sheer numbers of prisoners that they would end up with and what to do with them and how to house them, how to feed them and all that. That's very evident.
There's actually, not to leap ahead, but there's a moment in the heart of the story when these nine soldiers at various points have escaped, and there are a couple of them who at some point in their journey encounter several rebels, several Confederates, and they kind of understandably think the jig is up, but the two maybe higher-ranked officers kind of go off talking and so on, and ultimately what is decided is that these rebels are just not in a position to take these three Union soldiers into custody, and it's just not worth it to try to ferry them back to a Confederate prison, wherever that might be. And we're getting to that point in the conflict where taking prisoners makes less and less sense, and particularly for the Confederates as they find themselves, of course, in an increasingly desperate situation. It's important now for us to kind of get a sense of, once these various Union soldiers are able to escape prison, I mean, we're talking about these nine who we're talking about who are in this photograph, what they experience and how they make their way to freedom, how that occurred, and the kind of challenges that they faced. One of the things you tell us in your account is that for escaped prisoners of war, there was essentially the same sort of underground railroad that had existed, to some extent, still existed for fleeing slaves. Tell us more about the nature of this underground railroad and the kind of people who, in a sense, manned it and helped facilitate these escapees' journey to freedom.
Yeah, that was a surprise in the research of this. And it's interesting because it was definitely something that when they first escaped, they were traveling through kind of swampland, part of the Saluda River watershed leading into Columbia as they headed north, northwest. And they were encountering enslaved people in the plantations who would point them forward down the line and say, look for this gentleman or this individual at this next place or look for this crossroads or whatever. But when they got to North Carolina, they entered into this area where there were unionists. There were people that were never in favor of the Confederate Army and the conscription that it was doing to the men and all that stuff. They were really interested in just leading their lives because they didn't have a dog in the hunt, if you can imagine. They, in the one county that they first entered into, there was a sheriff. And the sheriff himself was the key to that underground railroad, per se, in that county. But at the same time, he was a member of the local Home Guard, which was a Confederate militia group, you know, tasked with keeping things, you know, normal, per se, to the population and looking out for escapees or runaways or whatever. Yet what he did was he acted kind of as a spy to that Home Guard group by knowing where the Home Guard was at any given time, and therefore any of the soldiers that he was helping, he could direct around the danger.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And, I mean, it was so good for the Union soldiers to have somebody like a Robert Hamilton in place and in that kind of position, and his wife Rhoda, for that matter. You mentioned her specifically, yeah, as well. And they work in tandem, and he, in effect, as you say, is a Unionist spy, and he can alert fleeing prisoners that the Home Guard, right now they're here, but soon they're going to be there, so the best place for you to go, and so on. And it's intriguing. At one point you mentioned that in the mountains of western North Carolina, where much of this story takes place, you say there was a fairly large contingent of Union sympathizers. And, of course, we don't often think about this. And at one point in the book, you talk about some of these that I think at one point you call mountaineers, who are, in a sense, hiding themselves away from the Confederates and just could not be pulled out of those mountains. I mean, they knew those mountains so well, and at least to a large extent could evade capture.
Yeah, and that was commonplace in western North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, and actually some parts of North Georgia. There was a strong contingent of people that were basically Unionists. They didn't want to secede from the United States. And but also what was occurring there, if you look at the terrain of that region, there are no battles that were fought in the mountains of these states, because it was very difficult to get around, and there was no train transportation through there. So it was either you're walking on or you're on horseback. And So what had happened was the mountains became kind of a refuge for a lot of other Confederate soldiers who had deserted, for people that were just looking to avoid it completely. And it was a pretty large mix of different kinds of people that way. But at the same time, there was still the influence of the Home Guard, and there were bands of men who would fight each other that weren't in either army, but were favoring one side or the other. Hmm. And it was really, I call it chaos in the mountains. It was really a chaotic place. You did not know which side you were going to be on, and it split families. A good example is the 14-year-old boy in the photograph. His family, the Zachary family in Cashiers, was a split family. And after the war, his grandfather, who was a strong Confederate supporter, actually said, "I will not have any member of my family who supported the Union cause be buried in our cemetery," which he was directing that at this boy's father, because that one son and his family were Unionists. Hmm. So he ended up, T.R. Zachary, the boy in the photograph's father, was Andy Zachary. He ended up creating another cemetery a quarter mile away from the other Zachary Cemetery. So there's now a upper Zachary Cemetery for the Unionists and a lower Zachary Cemetery for the Confederate supporters.
It's a good reminder of the painful divide between families that was just one more source of pain in this really brutal conflict, our own war between the states. Something else that is an intriguing facet of this story that not everyone will maybe expect is that at least some of these escaped Union soldiers escaping from Confederate prison were helped to a very substantial extent on their way by Negroes, by blacks. And for instance, there's a quote of one of these gentlemen saying, "The Negroes were as true as steel, and had not been for their assistance, we would have perished in the swamps." Tell us more about the blacks who played such an important role in this so-called Underground Railroad, and maybe some of the ways in which they were uniquely positioned to be an essential part of this story.
Well, the enslaved black population of South Carolina between Columbia going north, that these men went along that pathway, were most of them were in the plantations with maybe the women, the white women and children, but all of the men were away fighting the war. So you had a situation where through just the general grapevine of information passing between peoples, that they became aware and were aware by this time in 1864 that the Emancipation Proclamation had been passed. So when white Union soldiers were heading north, they looked to the enslaved black population for help, and they were absolutely helping them any way they could. And they traded two things between each other. For the white Union soldier, it was a place of refuge. It was hiding place. It was a hot meal. It was the ability to stop for the night and not be hunted. For the enslaved black population, it was information. Tell us about President Lincoln and him freeing us, and tell us about what that means. And the white Union soldiers would tell them about the Emancipation Proclamation. And that was a very important thing. I mean, if you think about what one gets from another, that was incredibly valuable information to understand it. And I think that the white Union soldiers had no idea what to expect when it came to the enslaved populations in this area, and were, to your point, in a quote, I believe that was from Michael Hoffman, just, you know, completely changed in their obvious, you know, biases that occurred then, regardless of which side you were on. So I think it was a learning situation for both parties.
I hope we can take just a little bit of time to talk more about the significant role played by these scouts or guides. And of course, as we mentioned before, there are three of them who are in this photograph of the 12 men. It's nine soldiers and then three local scouts or guides that help take them through the mountains. So first of all, it's probably important for us to know, at least this is, I think, a correct understanding, that we're not talking about this being an official job. I mean, this isn't like being a park ranger or a docent in a national park or something like that. I mean, this is, in a sense, an unofficial capacity that one would assume. First of all, am I right about that?
Yes, and in the case of there being three, obviously we've spoken about the one who's only 14 years old, so he was never conscripted into the Confederate Army, but the other two were, and the other two deserted the Confederate Army, and the other two then also enlisted in the Union Army, and actually deserted the Union Army. And the reason behind that is hard to say. I believe that a lot of it had to do with, again, that chaos in the mountains. Things were so difficult for their families back at home that I believe they wanted to be near their families to protect them. And so in the case of Kit Ledford is the name of the one of the scouts, he had enlisted along with his cousin in a Union regiment. And all of them, except for one, ended up coming back home. But yet then, they continuously would help these escaped soldiers make it to Union lines. The story of David Ledford, his cousin, the one that was killed in December of 1864, was he was captured along with two other Union officers, helping them escape the Union line. They did a similar thing to what they did with some of the officers in my story. They decided the officers, it wasn't worth their time taking them as prisoners, but they took David as a prisoner and they executed him. And so you had that happening. And so these scouts, per se, were taking great risk at moving through the mountains. And it was something that the Union officers definitely needed help in doing, because it was difficult terrain, and it was also a very cold and snowy winter. So they were traveling in horrible winter conditions, unable, whenever they stopped, to burn a fire because it would give their position away. And a scout was very important to them.
This young 14-year-old Thompson Roberts Zachary, or T.R. Zachary, you tell us that when this opportunity came his way to escort several of these soldiers to freedom, or to be part of that, you tell us T.R. Zachary was in heaven with his new job as a mountain guide. I mean, it's as though this was an opportunity he had waited for all his life. By and large, what is your sense of the motivation behind those who would take up this challenge/responsibility? I mean, was it for high-minded reasons, or was it for just kind of the thrill of it, for daring to face the danger of it?
I think it was the fact that they were doing what they felt was right. I think that they were, by this time, completely against what the Confederate side represented, and they were doing their duty, per se, and unrewarded, let's also say. I mean, it wasn't like they were paid to do this. And in fact, after the war, when Joseph Sisson, the third scout, applied for a pension, he was denied the pension. And it was because he had deserted his Union regiment. Yet I could find information that he was part of that Sheriff Hamilton's small band of men that were helping Union officers. So I think they did it because it was the right thing to do.
Well, ultimately, these men are able to make their way to freedom, but it is no small matter. And of course, one of the things you remind us is that in some cases they are men who are ultimately going to be returning to very complicated personal situations. I want to talk about that in just a moment. But first of all, describe whatever you think is particularly interesting about this moment when they are actually back on home soil. I mean, and what exactly was their ultimate destination when finally the nine men who we see in this photograph are actually all together? I mean, much of their journey to freedom is done separately. I mean, they've escaped from different places, and only just by chance do they all ultimately come together shortly before making it, in a sense, home. What was home? I mean, where did they need to get in, or what did they need to reach in order to finally be safe?
Well, the Union lines were along a pathway that went from Chattanooga to Knoxville, where the railroad was. It was a little bit to the east of the railroad, because obviously the lines protected the railroad, so you'd have the transportation between Chattanooga and Knoxville. So the town they actually ended up with in the early afternoon of New Year's Day, 1865, was Sweetwater, Tennessee, which is 45 miles from Knoxville. And they boarded a train, and it took them to Knoxville, and they arrived at Knoxville at night. And I think these kind of little details are fascinating, because that comes out of a diary that one of the men in the picture carried with him throughout the war. And to be able to find that kind of information, or to find out the information about the weather, is, to me, really interesting in storytelling. So at any rate, they made it to Knoxville that evening. They were put up in what was known as the Soldiers Hospital building, still standing today, the law library in Knoxville, and they spent the night. And Michael Hoffman, the gentleman with the diary, talks and recounts about how difficult it was, even though they were now free and they didn't have a worry in the world. He couldn't sleep because he was so excited. And they woke up the next morning. They had breakfast, which is an amazing thing for somebody that spent time in a prisoner of war situation. Food was provided to them. They had warm clothes to put on, but they chose not to put on those warm clothes. They chose to put on the same rags that they arrived in, and then head a few blocks into the center of town to find a photographer. They also needed to check in with the Provost Marshal General. That was important. But they wanted to do a photograph of themselves, and that's what resulted in this picture. The fact that they did that is remarkable, you know, that would be important. But after all this was done, the next day they all left on trains southbound to Chattanooga, then ultimately northbound to Nashville, Louisville, up towards Cincinnati, and then went their separate ways around Cincinnati, heading either east or west.
Explain what connection, if any of them had. I mean, you don't have to go through every single specific instance, but I am assuming that some of these men essentially never saw each other again. I mean, they were not, you know, the kind of group that would have tried to have a reunion every 5 years or something. And although there was some instance of reconnection, in general, they went their separate ways, correct?
That's correct. And also, let's also recognize the fact that just about every one of them had been wounded in some way during battles. And two of them in particular had been wounded, one in the temple, affected him psychologically the rest of his life. The other one had suffered heat stroke, affected him psychologically the rest of his life. So in some ways, I mean, today we would call this PTSD in addition to physical injuries. They all were dealing with PTSD. There's no doubt in my mind. You could tell it in the writing that they would have. Some of them were able to deal with it and move on with their lives and were successful in life, but a few of them weren't. And went through broken marriages and, you know, basically just lives lost. One of the men, one of the young guys in the picture, he was only 20 when the picture was taken, was from Kentucky, and he had contracted typhoid in the first 6 months that he was a soldier back in 1861. And he never really recovered from it and, in fact, had a hard time even making it through the conditions in the mountains. And he went back home. They all got leave, 30 or 60-day leaves, and his leave was never, it basically got extended, and then he was mustered out, and he unfortunately died in October of 1865 from heart disease, which is a kind of a side effect, I guess, of ongoing typhoid. They all had interest. It was interesting to delve into their lives after the war because, obviously, yes, they're all young men, and they've all been through this horrible war. Now what do you do? And, you know, so the same thing as soldiers in other wars in this country. They come back. There's a lot of people getting married. There's one that went through a divorce in 1865. They all start what would be their careers. One was a lawyer already. One becomes a lawyer. The one becomes a very successful retail merchant. They all have their different things they do. And you're right, most of them never reconnected again, but a few of them did. And one or two of them in particular traveled back and forth between where one of the other ones lived, not a short distance, but a pretty decent distance for that kind of time. And stayed in touch, including the 14-year-old boy with Mark Bassett.
Right.
He corresponded with Bassett and Bassett's wife after Bassett died.
It's so great to see that. And, of course, many of these men live well into the 20th century, and it's even just kind of remarkable to think about that and to think about how much the world changed over the course of their lifetime. I do want to have us just touch briefly on one fascinating matter with First Lieutenant Mark Bassett, who in so many ways is one of the central figures of this story. And he has a home situation that is particularly tragic, and it stems at least largely in part from a sad mistake that was made when he was mistakenly listed as having been killed in action. Explain what events that sets in motion and the way in which that ultimately rips apart his personal life.
Well, Mark Bassett was a lieutenant in the 53rd Illinois, Company E, and he had seen some pretty significant battle. He was captured in Jackson, Mississippi, as I had mentioned, and ended up in Libby Prison. And yes, he was reported as killed in action in the newspapers in Illinois. Right after the incident in Jackson. So he ended up in Libby, and his wife would have gotten the information and would have, you know, looked at her situation. They had three children together, young children, and would have eventually, after her grief, had to figure out how to survive. And she ended up taking up with another member of the same company who had been under her husband as a private, who had been wounded and basically sent home because of his injury. And she had, you know, basically developing a life with him, and then gets a letter from her husband saying that he's very much alive, living, you know, imprisoned in Libby prison. And I don't have the information during those years of what exactly went on between them, but Mark Bassett had a brother and a sister. Those were his only, his closest family. His parents were already gone by then. And that they lived in the same, the sister lived in the same small community, farming community in Illinois, and would trade letters with Mark, clearly letting him know what was going on. And, I mean, it got to be pretty sordid, is I would say the words. I was able to derive all this because they, when he got back, he divorced his wife, which was, you know, don't think of divorce in 1865, but it was happening. And I was actually able to get the entire divorce proceedings from the courthouse in Illinois that had all the depositions of all these people telling the tale of Mark Bassett's wife and how awful it was. And it was really odd because the men that she had taken up with were all connected to his infantry unit and knew him. So that was the other side of it that made for, you know, very strange stories, in my opinion. And that they would have known that Bassett was a prisoner of war, but yet here's his wife, and they're taking advantage of the situation, potentially, I would imagine.
I think,
so, he had a tough time.
And it is a poignant reminder of, in a sense, one more example of the chaos of war, and even in the 21st century, but certainly in the 19th century, when whole scale war is being waged to this extent, I mean the extent to which infrastructure disintegrates and communication, already limited, is even more limited, and even one mistake can, in a sense, set in motion a cascade of other complications. It is just one more reminder of just how painful this conflict ultimately was, and yet emerging out of it as well is an inspiring story like this one that is more interesting the closer you look. The book, again, is titled Captured Freedom. And one sees right on the cover of it this remarkable photograph of 9 Union soldiers escaped from Confederate prison and 3 of the guides who helped them find their way back to freedom. This book is published by There's History Around Every Bend, and its author, Steve Procco. Steve Procco, congratulations on this wonderful book, on all you managed to achieve through your research to tell this incredibly interesting story. And thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll be hearing interviews with several authors of children's books, including Carmen Agradidi, renowned children's book author, whose most recent is a humorous retelling of a Caribbean folktale called Carina Felina. We'll be talking with her tomorrow on The Morning Show. You'll find The Morning Show archive on our website, wgtd.org. Today is going to be sunny and pleasant with a high of 76 degrees, an overnight low of 53. But then the temperatures start climbing. Tomorrow, sunny and a high of 83. Saturday, sunny and 93. Sunday, sunny and 96. 96 also the high for Monday, Labor Day. Then we see things easing off at least a little bit. Tuesday, 93. Wednesday's forecast high, 89 degrees. So sunshine and quite a blistering heat wave over the course of most of the weekend into early next week. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR.